Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Adams. This episode features content from an educational webinar titled Strategies for Optimal HIV Treatment and Prevention, Answering the Questions on Switching ART, featuring Dr. Tristan Barber and Dr. Darcy Wooten. Dr. Barber is an honorary associate professor at the Institute for Global Health at University College London and a consultant in HIV medicine at the Ian Charlson Day Center at the Royal Free Hospital in London, United Kingdom. Dr. Wooten is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Global Public Health in the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, in San Diego, California. In this episode, they will answer questions and discuss key considerations when determining whether and how to switch antiretroviral therapy in virologically suppressed individuals with HIV. For the full online educational program, please visit the link in the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what Dr. Barber and Dr. Wooten have to say.
It's a great delight to be here with you all this evening, and thank you for joining this online presentation. So I think the issue of switching antiretroviral therapy in virologically suppressed patients is a really important one. I think it's our duty as HIV specialists to really review each of the components of our combined antiretroviral regimens and think about not only the viral effect that they're having, but what other impact they might be having on metabolic health, quality of life, or overall well-being as people get older with HIV in particular. We know we can achieve viral suppression really successfully, particularly with very potent second-generation integrase inhibitors, but what benefits or what potential harms are we causing above and beyond undetectability when people are on very long-term treatment for HIV infection? So these are some of the indications for switching antiretrovirals in virologically suppressed patients. You can see they may have documented antiretroviral toxicity. We may be trying to prevent long-term toxicities, thinking particularly about dyslipidemia, perhaps, or cardiovascular risk, a very hot topic in recent years. We may be trying to avoid drug-drug interactions. We know as people age that polypharmacy in the context of HIV is a common problem, and we may want to minimize the potential impact of long-term drug-drug interactions. Also, there may be some short-term reasons for avoiding DDIs, particularly thinking about prescribing in the context of TB co-infection, but also we've encountered a number of issues when people have a thrombosis, for instance, and are on anticoagulant medication, and we may need to switch to manage that with the optimal treatment for their thrombosis. We may need to think about conception or issues around pregnancy planning. And as I've touched on, there may be issues around aging or comorbidities, particularly cardiovascular risk, perhaps, but also thinking about long-term metabolic considerations. Now, we may also want to simplify people's therapy. We know historically people have sometimes been on multiple tablet regimens, or they've been on regimens containing drugs, for instance, that have boosters, and it may be possible to simplify them if they're naive to other classes, to other combinations that are either single tablet co-formulations or that do not include a booster, which may be causing complications. I mean, we may want to protect people against hepatitis B infection, particularly those who are vaccine non-responders. We may want to switch to increase the barrier to resistance. And one additional reason we might think about switching is perhaps to avoid dosing with food, which for some people can be a complication with their antiretroviral therapy. And finally, here in the list, this is certainly an issue in the UK, and this may be a variable pressure in other country and region specific settings, but we may want to decrease the cost of our antiretroviral therapy if this indeed is a consideration in your local environment. Just move us to our next slide. So what about switching in people with prior or unknown resistance patterns? We hear the M184V or I mutation discussed a lot currently, and there are a number of publications and conference presentations on this particular issue. I think it's fair to say that we're building our clinical confidence around switches to bictegravir, co-formulated with M-tricitabine, and tenofovir alafenamide in people with HIV who have a pre-existing M184V or I mutation. And this is based on a number of data sets, but particularly pooled data from the licensing studies of this particular drug regimen. We also see here data from the Paul Sachs pooled analysis of six phase three studies looking at just over 2,000 participants in people who were virally suppressed at baseline, but actually had an historic M184V or I that was noted in 10% of participants. 99% of those were virally suppressed with a viral load of less than 50 copies at the last visit prior to their switch to BF-TAF. And if you look at those who are present with an M184V or I mutation versus those who do not have this mutation, you can see that viral suppression rates are really very good, 99 versus 98%. And indeed, if you're switched to this particular combination, there was no failure with treatment emergent resistance. So overall, this is very encouraging for the use of this regimen in people with an isolated pre-existing M184V or I mutation. We also have data from the, from the BRAVE 2020 data set looking at the impact of baseline resistance on outcomes following a switch to BF-TAF in people living with HIV who were Black. This was a 2-to-1 randomized open-label active controlled phase three study and evaluated the switch from baseline regimens. These were two NRTIs with a third agent to BF-TAF in this particular population who were already virologically suppressed. This was a reasonably large data set. It was 495 participants, and it demonstrated that a switch to BF-TAF was non-inferior to remaining on your baseline regimen at week 24. And this was the primary efficacy endpoint in this particular study. People with baseline NRTI resistance remain suppressed at week 24 and also at week 48. And you can see here in the orange and green bars the comparison between those who had NRTI resistance present at baseline with very comparable rates of viral suppression in both arms. You can also see comparable rates in those with the M184V or M184I mutation at baseline. These rates were also comparable whether you received BF-TAF or whether you continued on your baseline regimen. Now, of course, in addition, we have data from the SALSA study. I think it's worth noting that this was a post hoc analysis. It wasn't a predetermined planned analysis. But when they looked back at those who had HIV viral loads of less than 40 copies per mil and also target not detected at week 48 by baseline resistance, you can see that the rates were really very good in SALSA. This, of course, was a stable switch study, switching people from a range of baseline regimens to dolutegravir and lamivudine. Now, I think it's worth highlighting here that the numbers of those who actually had resistance was quite low, but nonetheless, in those who did have resistance, you can see comparable rates of suppression in the dolutegravir-lamivudine arm compared to continuing on your triple therapy baseline regimen. And indeed, no participant in either arm met the confirmed virologic withdrawal criteria. Now, I have to say, in our own practice, we remain quite cautious, and I think we feel the evidence for BF-TAF in this scenario is a little bit more robust than switching to a dolutegravir-lamivudine combination, but this would be something that would be very interesting to pick up in the Q&A and see what you're doing in your own clinical practice. We do have the SOLAR-3D study as well. This was presented at EACTS in 2021 in London. This was looking at virologic outcomes from a switch to dolutegravir and lamivudine from a 3 or 4 drug regimen in people who had a confirmed M184V or I mutation. Now you can see in those with an historical M184V or I, this was a group of 50 participants, 92% remained undetectable in this scenario compared to 88% of those who did not have an M184V or I mutation. So this is quite a small study, but as you can see, virologic blips were rare and occurred with the same frequency in each group. There was no confirmed virologic failure across treatment arms and no treatment emergent resistance. I have to be honest, dolutegravir/lamivudine is one of my favoured regimens for switch in people who are suitable, but it remains the case, certainly in my setting, that if someone has a confirmed M184V, we would not switch to this regimen, despite the fact that we have some evidence perhaps suggesting that this is a safe switch strategy. But I still feel, erring on the side of caution, that if people have other options, that perhaps these are safer at this particular stage until we have more data to back up this approach. And finally, this is a French cohort, a retrospective analysis of switching to dolutegravir and lamivudine in people with an archived M184V or I mutation. The primary outcome here was the instance of virologic failure this time rather than viral suppression. And this was an HIV viral load confirmed at 50 copies per mil or over, or a single viral load that was above 200 copies. And they stratified this according to the presence of an archived M184V or I mutation. You can see that nearly 700 people switched to dolutegravir/lamivudine whilst they were suppressed. And of these, 15% had an archived M184V or I mutation. There was a median follow-up of 1.2 years. And what they concluded here was that there was no significant difference in the probability of virologic failure in those with versus those without these particular mutations, according to the time of detection prior to switch. So they looked at whether there was a significant difference in whether you'd had the mutation detected more than 5 years before switch or within 5 years before switch. And this was following on from previous data sets that had shown that the M184V was only important if it was detected in the recent 5 years. But here they concluded that in fact there was no particular difference and people had comparable viral suppression. And with that, I will hand over to my co-presenter, and I very much look forward to having a discussion around your questions later on. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dr. Barber. That was a fantastic overview about switching in sort of increasingly common scenarios that we see in clinic all of the time. We're going to switch gears, pun intended, to talk about switching antiretroviral therapy to specifically long-acting antiretroviral therapy. So I think it's been really exciting with the relatively recent use and approval of long-acting injectable cabotegravir and rilpivirine. This is just another tool in our toolkit that we can offer and might be a better option for certain patients versus others, maybe patients that are just really tired of taking a pill every day for their HIV, for example. And so this has really been a game changer for a lot of my patients personally in clinic and, of course, throughout the world. So if we look at the package insert and guideline recommendations in terms of who should we consider using long-acting injectable ART for and sort of what are the characteristics that would make somebody a really good candidate for this regimen, there are a couple of characteristics that could be considered. And so now, at least, the guidelines are recommending that this regimen should really only be considered for patients who are virologically suppressed and very stable on their oral therapy. I think this is an area that we're likely to see a lot of active change to sort of open up this indication for more patients. But at least as it stands currently, this group of patients who are virologically suppressed using this regimen as a switch regimen if patients are interested. Both cabotegravir and rilpivirine do not require any dose adjustment for renal impairment. And so you can use this regimen in a range of renal function criteria. And then because this medication does need to be at least currently administered in the clinic, in the healthcare setting, it is a consideration that patients who are engaged in their healthcare and who come to appointments frequently and consistently really make them optimal to receive this therapy. And then the guidelines talk about some contraindications to this regimen. Of course, resistance to either agent in the regimen would be a contraindication, but also to consider resistance in the class of integrase inhibitors or NNRTIs. They do point out that the K103N mutation is not an absolute contraindication to this regimen since it doesn't confer resistance to rilpivirine, but this might be a good area for discussion in the Q&A section in terms of could there be additional resistance that we're not seeing in the presence if we just identify the K103N, and would we really feel comfortable switching a patient to this regimen if we know that a K103N is present and maybe other NNRTI resistance mutations are present. Guidelines also recommend that this regimen be avoided or is suboptimal if patients have a history of virologic failure, mainly because these patients were excluded from the clinical trials where this was studied. And then importantly, patients with chronic hepatitis B co-infection, whether that's a cold infection or active infection, really should be cautious and shouldn't use this regimen because this regimen doesn't have any agents that are active against hepatitis B. So if you're switching a patient off of a tenofovir-containing regimen and they have hepatitis B co-infection, that could put them at risk for a hepatitis B flare. And so that would be a contraindication to switching over to this regimen in the context of not adding an agent for hepatitis B, such as entecavir. So when we're thinking about switching patients to long-acting injectable therapy, I think one thing that can help inform our decision and discussion with patients is thinking about and looking at what are risk factors for virologic failure in patients receiving long-acting cabrilpivirine. And this was a post-hoc analysis of ATLAS FLAIR and ATLAS 2M looking at that specific question. So there weren't a large number of patients who had virologic failure across all of these studies. But when they looked at this, there were four features that really did sort of pan out to be associated with a higher risk of failure and higher odds ratio of virologic failure. And this is important because we know that when this regimen fails patients, they often develop resistance to the agents in the regimen, including integrase resistance. So the factors associated with increased risk of virologic failure included having a baseline rilpivirine resistance associated mutations, having a low week 8 rilpivirine trough concentration, not something that we typically measure in clinical practice, having infection with HIV-1 subtype A6A1, and then having an elevated BMI at baseline greater than or equal to 30. And I think one thing to point out with this study is that really it was having two or more of these risk factors that really started to increase the risk for virologic failure. The risk was still relatively low with, of course, zero or just one risk factor. And then we'll wrap up with a brief discussion about what to do in this situation that I see every day in my practice of how do we manage antiretroviral therapy when we've started on someone on a regimen, and specifically a second generation integrase inhibitor, and they've experienced weight gain. And they come in and see you and they're not happy about the weight gain and they want to know whether they should switch off of their regimen to something else to help mitigate that weight gain. So we know that weight gain definitely occurs when patients are started on antiretroviral therapy. Some of this is a quote unquote return to health phenomenon, but there's also a component of antiretroviral agents playing a role here. And there's a little bit of a differential when we look at different classes of antiretroviral therapy. So this was a nice pooled analysis by Paul Sachs looking across 8 different trials in treatment naive individuals started on different regimens and looked at which ones were associated with more weight gain compared to the other regimens. And so in the panel on the left, you can see that integrase inhibitors in the orange were associated with significantly more weight gain compared to patients who were started on PIs or NNRTIs. And then when you try to sort out which integrase inhibitors are really driving this weight gain, in the middle panel, you can see that bictegravir and dolutegravir were associated with significantly more weight gain compared to elvitegravir. So our second generation integrase inhibitors seem to really be playing a role. And then finally, in the right panel, there's a difference in weight gain seen when you're started on different NRTIs, and in particular, TAF in orange was associated with more weight gain compared to the other NRTIs, including TDF. We also know from the ADVANCE trial, as well as other trials, that particular patient characteristics and demographic features are associated with more weight gain on integrase inhibitors as well as TAF compared to TDF. So this is an additional follow-up analysis of the ADVANCE trial, which was a randomized controlled trial comparing three different regimens in treatment-naive individuals, dolutegravir FTC TAF compared to dolutegravir FTC TDF compared to efavirenz FTC TDF. And what we saw in the study that was that dolutegravir compared to efavirenz was associated with significantly more weight gain, and TAF compared to TDF was also associated with significantly more weight gain. But what we see when we look at more specific demographic features is that women compared to men experienced even more weight gain, and in particular, Black females were associated experienced more weight gain compared to non-Black females. And so this is a well-documented observation in that different patient populations and subgroups might be at risk, higher risk for experiencing weight gain associated with some of our newer antiretrovirals. So whenever I have a clinical conundrum that I don't know what to do with, I turn to the guidelines and the data to see how I should approach this situation. And if we look at what the current DHHS and other guidelines recommend in terms of what to do when patients gain weight on antiretroviral therapy, it's not totally clear cut and again, a great opportunity for us to have some discussion here. The guidelines do acknowledge that weight gain definitely can occur. And in particular, we're seeing more weight gain with dolutegravir and bictegravir, as well as TAF compared to TDF. And it is really important, and I've definitely been doing this more in my practice, to have longer conversations and more intense conversations with patients when we're starting antiretroviral therapy to really let them know that this is something to look out for and to potentially even expect, and really to start to counsel them on diet, exercise, lifestyle modifications, almost in a prophylactic way to see if we can't mitigate some of this weight gain, especially the weight gain that occurs within the first 3 to 6 months after starting therapy. The guidelines also acknowledge that certain subgroups are at higher risk for experiencing significantly more weight gain, and that could be noted. But in terms of what to do with it, the guidelines say there's not really a lot of data out there to guide our clinical practice here. So it's not known, and there's very limited data, although we're seeing more come out, which is great. But there's not that much data that suggests that if you switch to a different class or a different regimen, that that will either stabilize the weight gain or result in having that patient return to a lower weight at their baseline. So it's not clear that switching to different strategy, a different regimen will impact that weight gain. And that's not something that I'm routinely doing in my practice, just because there's not too much data to support that. If I have the opportunity, I'll try and enroll a patient in one of the trials that's looking at switching off of an integrase inhibitor when weight gain occurs, for example, so that we can get this really high quality data that we need in order to help make management decisions in clinic. And then, you know, the guidelines patients also discuss, and this is definitely an area that I've had conversations with my colleagues about, is that we really need more information and more data in terms of really understanding what the impact of this weight gain is when patients get started on these therapies, because we're starting to see more and more metabolic complications associated with integrase inhibitors, for example. So higher rates of fasting glucose and diabetes within the first 6 months after starting, increased cardiovascular risk, increased cardiovascular events after starting what we think of as our first line integrase inhibitors, which are so effective in terms of controlling HIV. I think one of the big questions is we don't know whether the risk is due to the weight gain that people experience of these metabolic complications, or is there some kind of direct effect that's taking place from the medication itself? So a lot remains unknown, and people are actively working on these questions, which is great. So we'll wrap up with some key points on weight gain and antiretroviral therapy. We know that it's common. We should be counseling our patients when we're starting therapy, that this is something to expect and really have a good proactive plan in place in terms of how to address healthy diet and exercise. The second generation INSTIs, so bictegravir, dolutegravir, really seem to be associated with more weight gain when we start therapy compared to other classes. And we see that there's a differential effect in women versus men, and in particular, Black women. We also see the same differential in weight gain when we compare TAF to TDF. And here, it's not clear, is TAF actually causing weight gain, or is there some sort of weight stabilizing or weight suppressive effect from TDF? Of course, the benefits of TAF in terms of bone health and renal health is important to consider as well, but we have to balance that with the weight gain that we're seeing as well. So at this time, at least according to the guidelines, it's unclear that switching off of these agents is going to be beneficial. We don't know if it's going to reverse the weight gain. And there's so many positives and so many good things in terms of virologic control that we've seen with second generation integrase inhibitors. So this isn't something switching because of weight gain is not something that I'm routinely doing in my practice. There are a few exceptions, but this is definitely something that we all want more information on so we can really have an evidence-based approach to this clinical issue. So with that, I think, well, thank you so much for your attention and participation, and look forward to taking a peek at the questions that you've been putting in and having a conversation with you all. And feel free to drop questions into the Q&A section, and we will go through those.
Fantastic. Dr. Darcy Wootton, that was a fantastic overview. Thank you very much indeed. Really enjoyed the discussion about weight. Before we go to the questions in the chat, I wonder if I can take a sort of prerogative and ask you a couple of questions. There was a fantastic data set presented, I think, from San Diego at the Montreal World AIDS Conference about real world experience of using injectable cabotegravir and rilpivirine. I think we're a bit behind the curve, certainly in the UK at the moment, in terms of real world data around using these agents. But I just wonder if you've used a lot of injectable cab and rilpivirine. And I know the data suggests that two risk factors are necessary for failure, but I feel like whilst I'm building my confidence in this fairly novel strategy, I'll be quite cautious about people with even one risk factor. I wondered how you feel, for instance, about leaping straight in with your first prescription in someone who has, let's say, a BMI of 35, or whether you kind of selected the people at the beginning that you used to kind of build your confidence in a very safe space.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I don't know if I have a perfect answer to that. We have done quite a lot of transitioning patients from oral therapy to long-acting injectable cabrilpivirine. I think at this point, we have a clinic of about 3,500 patients with HIV. And I think we've started somewhere between 150 to 200 patients on long-acting cabrilpivirine. Part of that, I would say 90% of that has really been the successes is attributed to our clinical pharmacists, who are absolutely amazing in terms of coordinating all of that. To your question of, you know, if a patient has a risk factor like elevated BMI, how comfortable, you know, would we feel switching them, knowing that that could put them at risk for virologic failure? That's something that I do talk to my patients about, that this has been identified as a risk factor. And I really have a sort of individualized approach and conversation with the patient. So if it's a patient who they just have been so excited about injectable therapy, they really hate taking their pill every day and they just can't wait to get onto injectable therapy. And it's such a motivating drive and something that they really want. I sort of talk to them about that risk, but then go ahead and proceed and just monitor them closely. We have switched patients who have elevated BMI to long-acting cabralpiprine, and numbers are small, but haven't seen any virologic breakthrough. And so just kind of talk to them about that risk, but then sort of take a patient-centered approach, monitor a little bit more frequently, and then also kind of give them that carrot incentive of, and let's focus on how we can, you know, work on your weight, diet, and that type of thing. And a lot of the medications that we're using for weight also happen to be injectables, like the GLP-1 receptor agonist, for example. And so I have patients joke with me that I'm turning them into pincushions. And so it's also a good way to kind of have the conversation about addressing weight. Yeah, thank you for that.
I've seen your face and thought you were a mean pincushion sort of person. Yeah, no, I'm sure. I'm going to ask you one final question before we jump to the ones that are in the chat. I'm kind of aware that we've neglected non-nucleosides a little bit in this discussion. And I think I agree with you about waiting for data around weight gain, but I wonder if, in some ways, we're also guilty of emperor's new clothes behavior with our single tablet regimens that sometimes contain second generation INSTIs and tenofovir alafenamide. Some of the weight data around using co-formulated doravirin, for instance, suggests that it's pretty favorable. It may not reverse other antiretroviral induced weight gain. One of my preferred regimens is actually still TDF FTC with raltegravir. I know some patients really insist on a single tablet regimen, but in terms of metabolic toxicity and weight gain, that combination is actually, you know, really, really positive. We don't see a lot of negatives with that. And so I just wondered what you think about the use of multi-tablet regimens that feel for some people like we're going backwards a little bit, or co-formulated non-nucleosides with TDF in this context?
Yeah, that's a great question, and definitely something that I have a little bit of experience with some of my patients. I think for the right patient, taking, let's say, two pills a day versus one pill a day is really no different to them. For other people, you know, they lose one bottle and then they only have one, and then it can be more problematic. And so I think for you again, kind of individualize it to the patient, and some patients really don't have a preference of one tablet versus two tablet regimens. So that's kind of one piece, and I explore that with my patients when we're thinking about that. And then, as I was kind of alluding to, I haven't switched people because of weight gain, with a few exceptions, and one of those exceptions, and there's not data to really back this up, but a regimen that I have switched people to, a few people to, is doravirine 3TC TDF. Because they've essentially told me I'm not going to take my antiretrovirals because of this weight, so please switch me to something else. And you know, that is being looked at, and hopefully we'll have results from the DO-IT trial to see if that is an effective strategy to switch with respect to weight. I think really important to remember there, right? If you're switching from a second generation INSTI to doravirine, you're moving to lower barrier to resistance. And so you need to think about, of course, any baseline underlying resistance that might be present, and then also adherence, and if there's any adherence issues. Similarly, going from second generation INSTI to raltegravir are going to be a lower barrier to resistance. Again, for some patients who are super, super adherent, it's not going to be an issue. And so again, you kind of individualize it to the patient and sort of see, you know, if that switch is going to make sense for them. But I think that those are going to be hopefully promising approaches. And I'm really excited to see the data on that.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a key point there, which is that, of course, the resistance profile of doravirin looks good in vitro, but we still don't have any clinical data about how it performs in real world situations in people that are harboring NRTI or NNRTI mutations. And I think that would be really important data to have. I'm going to hand over to you to maybe ask me some of the questions in the chat, because I feel like I've questioned you a little bit.
Yes. Well, thank you for those. Those were wonderful. And I always learn so much listening to you. We do have a question from Leon asking, would you be comfortable switching to BICF-TAF in a virally suppressed patient who's on a second line PI regimen with a K65R as per the Nadia trial?
Really good question. So I think we are doing this in clinical practice in a few people. I think the data from the 1489 and 1490 studies did show that there are a handful of people who had a K65R. I think the question here is whether it's an isolated K65R or whether you suspect or you know that they have other NRTI mutations, or indeed whether they have alternative options that might be better. So in people with reasons to not have a boosted regimen who need to get off of a boosted PI, we certainly have switched people successfully with an isolated K65R. And we have some people who in addition have had some NRTI mutations. But I do think some other NRTI mutations, I should say, in addition. But I think what you do need to do in these people is ensure they're the kind of people that will come in for some regular monitoring initially, because data remains quite limited in the use of BF-TAF in this scenario. So the answer is, if they don't have other options, they really need to switch. We certainly would consider it. You need to weigh up the other existing or suspecting resistance that might be present. And you need to encourage them to come in for some early monitoring just to check they're safe.
Yeah, I agree with that. And kind of always sort of weighing, you know, what is the indication to get off the booster and to switch, and how strongly is that driving your decision? And then looking into that detailed resistance pattern and profile and understanding that. Do you want me to read the next question?
No, you go for it. I'll take the next one.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So Sungheem's asking, we share the hesitation to switch to dolutegravir 3TC in patients with pre-existing M184V or I mutation due to availability of limited patient data. What are your thoughts on switching to another dolutegravir-based regimen, such as dolutegravir 3CT abacavir in pre-existing M184V or I cases?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we do have people with an M184 who are on Trimec and are successfully suppressed, or dolutegravir, lamivudine, abacavir. I mean, I think this feeds into one of the questions that I was going to ask more generally is, I'll be interested what you think, Darcy, but whether there is any rationale to using abacavir in modern antiretroviral combinations, in the sense that, okay, I don't feel the cardiovascular data is entirely clear, but I feel that abacavir is sometimes adding a potential long-term risk that may not be compensated by any additional benefit it may be offering, when there's probably better data about regimens to use in confirmed M184V or I cases. So I think we're back to that individualization of therapy. Maybe if you're limited in terms of treatment options, maybe in someone who's had a lot of excessive weight gain on a tenofovir, alafenamide, and second generation INSTI-based regimen, this might be a potential option. But I certainly wouldn't think about, at the moment, wouldn't use dolutegravir, lamivudine in isolation unless this person really had, no other treatment options at all. I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, I think we overlap in terms of what we're thinking about in that approach. It's really difficult for me to think of a scenario where I would want to use abacavir. Like you mentioned, the cardiovascular data, which of course is complex, but all things other being equal, otherwise we have lots of other, I think, better and safer options. So I think, you know, if you did have somebody who had an M184V and you didn't feel comfortable doing dolutegravir 3TC, I think, you know, having tenofovir alafenamide on board in a fixed dose combination It's hard to come up with a scenario where you wouldn't be able to use TAF in the regimen. It might be very kind of specific cases, but I think those will be very few and far between. And so I think that, you know, the data on WTIV-3GC in the setting of M1A4V mutation is nice. It's nice to see. I don't know that it is practice changing, except for maybe in these very, very rare scenarios where you don't want to use the back of ear because of cardiovascular risk. You don't want to use TAF because of very, very, you know, impaired renal function and potentially, you know, weight issues, but probably the TAF isn't contributing all that much to the weight issue if they're on second generation INSTI. So again, it kind of, you almost have to work to come up with a scenario where you couldn't find an alternative regimen.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Let's take Andrew's question, which is, would you bother switching someone who is on a three pill, i.e. TDF-FTC with a boosted PI regimen, if they're adherent and stable and don't have resistance data, given the risk of weight gain?
This is a great question. And I remember one of my attendings when I was training always sort of told me, whenever you think about switching somebody to a different regimen, make sure you have a really good reason to switch, because if you're switching kind of just to switch and there's not a really good reason, there's always a risk that something could go wrong when you switch. So with that kind of living in the back of my mind, you know, a lot of times we do have to switch off boosted PIs because of drug-drug interactions. But if the patient is young, healthy, stable on this regimen, their bone health, their renal health is stable, and you're monitoring that, you don't have to switch. They're doing well. And, you know, you could talk or, you know, talk to them if they wanted to be on a single tablet regimen, they could without changing the components of the regimen, or they could stay where they are. Or, you know, if you and or they were interested in switching to a second generation INSTI, I think that's a conversation to have, you know, if they have a lot of dyslipidemia and that's an issue for them, that might be a place to start that conversation. Although as we're seeing the cardiovascular risks and weight gain with second generation INSTIs, you might not come out ahead there. So I think those are kind of a few thoughts on that particular scenario. Maybe it doesn't make sense to switch. There was also some recent data that was presented at IAS that I'll just say was, you know, observational. So we do need to take that with sort of a grain of salt. But it was a study looking at patients who were started on an integrase inhibitor. Then they experienced weight gain. And then after experiencing weight gain, they were switched. And this is, again, kind of just in clinical practice. And then they observed sort of what happened. They switched either to a different integrase inhibitor or to a boosted PI. And so those patients who were switched to the boosted PI regimen, they had what looked to be some stabilization in their weight, whereas the patients who were switched to a different INSTI continued to have weight gain. So lots of confounding that's difficult to control for in that type of study. And again, there's RCTs taking place looking to see if switching off of second generation INSTIs to other regimens is going to be helpful for weight. But that might be a little bit of a signal that maybe, you know, maybe we might end up going back to PIs for some patients or NNRTIs. So again, lots more to come, I think. And I always like to make sure I have really good data to inform my practice, but that's just the reality is that we don't always have that data available. Then we have to kind of make the best decision in having that conversation, talking about the risks and benefits with the patient. What do you think about that?
I'm going to have some colleagues who are really going to be looking at me and smiling if it turns out that boosted PIs were the solution to everything, because my gut feeling is that we've been very good at managing people on TDF with monitoring bone health, monitoring renal function. In the context of a boosted PI, of course, we have to bear in mind that the TDF is slightly boosted, and so the risk of toxicity long term is potentially a little bit higher. My gut feeling has always told me that boosted PIs are probably bad for people that don't need them. Boosted PIs have a great role, but I would say of about every 100 people I've switched off of a boosted PI in the last 3 or 4 years, usually to a second generation integrase inhibitor, 95 have done really well, and 5 have had some weight gain. So what I really want here is I really want a way to be able to predict those people that are at risk of antiretroviral induced weight gain. And of course, we don't have that. So I guess what we really end up doing here is almost a population-based decision that overall, I feel like I'm benefiting the people that I switch away from these regimens. But for a few people, I may be doing them harm. So what I really need to do is make sure I'm recording their weight well, that I'm advising them about watching out for weight gain, and switching them if they clearly have weight gain that's related to their antiretroviral switch. It's really challenging.
I completely agree with you on that sentiment of being able to predict who is going to go on to have a lot of weight gain, because I think those are the, if we can identify those people, then we might use a different approach to their first line therapy than what we kind of apply to, you know, everybody else. And so I think having that information, and even, you know, because I think there are some data, though they're observational, that, you know, this early weight gain very early on and excessive weight gain early on is definitely a predictor that things aren't going well. And so, you know, I've started to try and bring patients back a little bit sooner and monitor their weight a little bit more frequently as well. Again, trying to get a sense of who's sort of on this, you know, not optimal trajectory. And then we might think about other strategies there.
Yeah. I'm going to take Atakan's question from beautiful Izmir. Hi, Atakan, I hope you're well. What's your current practice and experience on patients with M184V mutations? Is there any data that shows additive mutations may be seen more frequently in patients on dual therapy with this mutation? So at the moment, mostly because co-formulated dolutegravir and lamivudine has a very matched half-life, we see this interesting data about continuing viral suppression in people with an M184V. We don't see failure with additional resistance, including with integrase inhibitor resistance. Where you did see failure on dolutegravir lamivudine with the development of integrase resistance is in the Gemini study, but that's where you were using separate components for dolutegravir and lamivudine, so people may have discordantly adhered to those components. But with a single tablet combined co-formulation of dolutegravir and lamivudine, we don't see the development of additional resistance and failure. I don't know if you'd agree, Darcy.
Yeah, I agree. And then the one thing I just want to add on, it's going back a little bit to our conversation before, but in the SALSA and TANGO trials where patients were switched to dolutegravir 3TC, even though there was no benefit in weight there, so that's not, switching to that regimen is not going to do anything for weight for your patients. There was some improvement in lipid profile. So that's also, again, something to think about, but not necessarily, you know, if you have an M184V mutation, that's going to be a little bit trickier there. But without that, then that can be helpful in terms of the lipid profile. I will jump to Luisa's question on long-acting cabralpivirine. So when using long-acting injectable cabralpivirine, do you think that using a bigger, larger needle in people with high BMI addresses this concern, or could there still be a pharmacodynamic issue putting these patients at risk of failure in spite of using the appropriate needle? So I think that definitely you've identified that risk, and it's not clear, at least to me, as far as I know, that using that longer 2-inch needle is going to solve all of the issues. I think it's not necessarily going to hurt anything and will potentially help to maybe get a little bit better trough targets. But I think that's maybe still a little bit unknown, but I don't think too many downsides to doing that. So that's still something to maybe, you know, keep in mind and be cautious about in terms of using this agent in patients with elevated BMI. Although again, kind of always weighing those risks and benefits and taking into account kind of the patient's priorities and preferences too. What do you think on that one, Tristan?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we are yet to really have any good real world data in the UK. We've been a little bit behind the curve here. We're just starting to get really access to injectable cab and rilpivirine. I think we clearly will be using the longer needle in people with a BMI over 30. And as I've said, I think we'll be building our confidence in the people who are most I hate this because it's a tiny bit paternalistic, but I think it's normal in medicine that when you start something that's quite novel, you're going to pick the people initially that really don't have risk factors for failure and try and build your confidence. And once you've got, you know, once things are flowing, once you've got the system up and running, you'll start diversifying a bit more. You'll be, you know, hopefully gain confidence about using the larger needle. Nurses will feel more confident about administration, but we're still at that very early stage, if you like, where we haven't really yet got up and running. And that's going to happen in the next few weeks, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, along those lines, I think the other question that always comes up is, you know, using long-acting cabrilpivirine in somebody who's viremic and or somebody who really struggles to get to clinic visits. And I think we don't have data on that, right? That's not guideline recommended if somebody's viremic and using that regimen. But there was a nice demonstration project that just came out of San Francisco. Numbers were small, again, observational data, but the large majority of the patients, who it was a very marginalized kind of underserved patient population with lots of barriers to care, many of whom were viremic and they got started on long-acting cabrilpivirine. Vast majority of them were virologically suppressed at the last observation. So that's promising. And I would love to see more data on that because patients who really struggle to get to clinic and that adherence to clinic visits, that would be a patient population that I think would so benefit from this regimen. But you do have to be cautious just because of those long tails. And then, you know, if you lose the patient to follow up and they've got subtherapeutic levels because they don't get switched over to an oral bridge or something, then you could be putting them at high risk for developing resistance. So you want to be able to use that type of regimen for patients who struggle with adherence, but you've got to do so cautiously. And I wouldn't do so quite yet until we have more data and it's in the guidelines. But if the data do support that, I think that will be very beneficial for patients who have barriers to adherence and care.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up because Monica Gandhi was the senior author on that paper and on that poster. And I thought it was one of the most impactful things from the Montreal conference. I really wish that had the opportunity to be orally presented and discussed because it was really, you know, pragmatic medicine. You know, it was a real approach with an MDT that were focused on supporting these people. And it's a question that comes up all the time. You know, we've got someone who finds it really difficult to swallow tablets or to take tablets. They're viremic. Why can't we give them injectables? They may really benefit. And this was done in a really safe way. As you say, it's not in line with guidance or with guidelines or with the product license, but it just, for me, it was really sensible, safe, cautious, fantastic medicine. And it really did show that there were good rates of viral suppression in the 15 people who entered who were viremic. And I think in the two who didn't suppress, they at least showed a two log reduction with either the first or the second injection. I'd have to go back, but I think within 8 weeks, they'd shown a two log reduction in viral load. So it was really, really fantastic. And everyone should have a look at that poster. I think we should do quick fire on what we've got left. I'm going to talk to Ekaterini's question, weight gain plus dyslipidemia. If a decision to switch was made, what would be your regimen of preference? I have to be honest. Again, we talked about Emperor's New Clothes a little bit, but I would try and include TDF in this person if it wasn't otherwise contraindicated. We know TDF for some reason puts a brake on even normal weight gain. We know it can have a favorable effect on lipids. And I would certainly avoid a booster if possible. If you've got someone in this situation who's on tenofovir alafenamide with a second generation INSTI, I try and do a staggered switch to try and see which one's contributing. I do find if you switch the second generation INSTI and tenofovir alafenamide at once, you never quite know what the contributor was. But that would be my kind of approach. I don't know what you think, Darcy.
I think I would probably stay the course in the vast majority of patients. And I, you know, would do diet and exercise and then medication for hypercholesterolemia, statin therapy is very, very effective. And then, like I mentioned before, I've been using a lot of GLP-1 receptor agonists, which have been amazingly effective. They're difficult to get covered by insurance at times, but we've had some success. And so I would kind of focus on the other strategies as a general approach.
Yeah. No, very wise. Leonos, well, mentions in the advanced trial weight gain seemed to be related to how people metabolize efavirenz. I'm not going to go into this comment in detail. It's a very interesting comment, but I think this really feeds back into our discussion earlier that what we really need is ways to better identify how individuals metabolize drugs and what their risk factors are for weight gain on different agents. And as yet, we don't really have those markers. And then I'm going to go to, I think, well, this is quite a specific question. It's a patient example from Ahmed, who says, I had a 20-year-old male, HIV positive, PCP positive, CMV positive, non-compliant with a CD4 less than 140, diagnosed with active TB. He's currently taking dolutegravir with emtricitabine and tenofovir. I'm going to presume it's TDF with cotrimoxazole. They want to start a four-drug regimen for his TB, but there are a lot of DDIs. We don't have alternative medications for his TB. Now, there isn't a specific question here, but obviously you have to optimize his treatment to ensure a minimum in terms of DDIs and interactions here, and try and avoid any toxicities from the combination of his TB therapy with his antiretroviral therapy. And these combinations remain quite challenging. But I agree, the data for, of course, bictegravir in this situation is not so good with rifampicin. So I think you have a good combination there. What would you use, Darcy, in that scenario?
Yeah, I think we have access to rifabutin, which seems to have less drug-drug interaction with our second-generation INSTIs. Well, specifically dolutegravir, don't use bictegravir with the rifamycins. And so I would try to use rifabutin and dolutegravir, and you can still dose the dolutegravir once a day. If you had rifampin and didn't have rifabutin, then you could just tack on dolutegravir by itself as a second dose, and then keep the dolutegravir, emtricitabine, tenofovir. One thing that does come up is TDF versus TAF with rifamycins, and at least in my institution, and it's I think the guidelines are changing in this direction, is that TAF is probably okay to use, at least with rifabutin. Not I think widespread standard practice, but there are some PKPD data showing that everything works out okay in that scenario. So that's another kind of more minor drug-drug interaction to think about, but something that comes up fairly frequently. And if you don't feel comfortable using TAF with the rifamycins, then you can switch people over for TDF for the time that they're being treated for TB, and then put them on TAF if that makes sense afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Stephanie, what are your thoughts on best practices if someone's admitted and their regimen is unavailable? Switching while they're admitted and then switching back, obviously not optimal, however, a frequent problem. You know, we do sometimes do this in short-term therapy, particularly, for instance, if people are admitted to ITU or they can't swallow, we'll often switch their therapy temporarily and switch them back later on. And I think if you can maintain viral suppression, even if you've got an inability to access their usual drugs, that's usually better over the short term than allowing them to become viremic, although sometimes, of course, you do end up allowing them to temporarily interrupt therapy. If they're on something with a long tail, you need to try and manage that to avoid the risk of resistance.
And I would just add, I think the pearls there would be, you know, make, if you can, and you have to switch from what they're on as an outpatient, trying to stay within class and also trying to stay within barrier to resistance. So it's suboptimal to go from something that has a low barrier to a high barrier, unless you know they don't have any resistance mutations and that type of thing. And if you can review their history of their genotypes and resistance and adherence, that can also help inform those switches and what would be safe to switch to temporarily in the inpatient setting.
Thank you very much to Drs. Barber and Wooten, and thank you to you, our listeners, for joining in. Please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you, and have a great day.